Let me call the meeting to order. As you know, I'm not Judge Blasio. But in his absence, I'm going to call the roll and try to go through at least the first couple of things on the agenda. Thank you all for coming. I know meetings in December are especially tricky, so we appreciate you being here. We have a few cancellations. There are several members who will not be coming due to weather-related issues. Notably on our agenda are researchers from Case Western Reserve University were unable to attend. So we'll have to talk about how best to communicate that their draft report where we can end up with what they presented or at least have in their minds in the next few months. So, and we'll in the meantime be working with DRC on a few issues. So let me call the roll. And Crystal Alexander, Laura Baker Morris,
here.
Representative Boggs?
Here.
Welcome. We have some new appointments, so Representative Boggs is one of those. Thank you for joining us. Paula Brown?
Here.
Judge Delamater? Judge DeFranco? Judge Dumb? Senator Eklund?
Here.
Judge Fregali? Judge Gwynn? Judge Jameson? Judge Marceline?
He's here.
Thank you. He's checked in. Chip McConville. Judge McIntosh. Kevin Miller.
Here.
Gary Moore. Kyle Petty.
Here.
Mayor Mon is not here. Representative Redbeck.
Here.
Judge Spanigal.
Here.
Director Reed.
Here.
Sheriff Sims?
Here.
Senator Thomas? Tim Young?
Here.
And then for our advisory committee members, Jill Wheeler?
She's here.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Professor Berman? Jim Cole?
Here.
Lori Chris? Beth Scalina? Paul Dobson? Steve Gray? I'm going through these because I know they're not coming. Brian Martin?
Here.
Cindy Mouser.
Here.
Jason McGowan. Carlton Moore.
Here.
Justice Kaiser. Dave Pickin.
Here.
Judge Spade.
Present.
And Carrie Williams. All right. Thank you very much. So moving on through the agenda, if you had an opportunity to review the minutes of our meeting in September on September 21st, and there's Joe Spaggio.
I am late.
We're happy to have you there. So, we're just to the point of discussing the minutes from our September 21st meeting. And if there's a motion to approve those minutes.
So moved. Spanigal.
Thank you, Judge Spanigal. And second?
Second.
Director Reed. Were there any additions or corrections or revisions that needed to be made to those minutes? Hearing none, all in favor of approving the minutes from our meeting on September 21st, please say aye.
Aye.
Is anyone opposed? And does anyone abstain? All right, great. Thank you very much. So Judge Salaggio, our researchers from Case Western Reserve University are unable to be with us this morning. Judge Gallagher is on his way. So you may want to move through to committee reports if that needs the approval of the group. Oh, and there's Judge Gwynn. Thank you, Judge Gwynn. And just let me know when you're ready to take over.
I'm just powering up.
So, Judge Savaggio, that Representative Boggs is one of our new appointments. Sheriff Sims has been formally appointed since we last met, as well as Prosecutor Ponto. So, welcome all of them. Moving into committee reports, the Juvenile Justice Committee held off and is unable to be with us today. The co-chair is Jill Wheeler. But you'll see in the meeting agenda, pretty much laid out what the group has been working on. In January, we'll be looking more at the data components regarding juvenile justice. We're going to hear from the JDAI folks, get a little bit more information on how best to approach this juvenile probation reform topic. We've been struggling with that, and it's just, there's a lot to it, and we want to make sure we're not duplicating efforts that are being done in other places as well as here, and get a good sense of what it is we want to try to accomplish. Our researchers, the same researchers that have done our House Bill 86 impact analysis, have in other work that they've done, a lot of work on juvenile justice related information, and so they have several sets of data and reports that they'd like to present to our juvenile justice group to give them a sense of what's happening in juvenile justice analysis. And then one of the topics that we spent a lot of time at least bantering about was in your meeting materials, you saw a draft for a legislative impact analysis. The committee, the Juvenile Justice Committee specifically, but then more broadly as the commission, we should have some sense or protocol on how and if and when we weigh in on particular legislative bills or issues or topics. And so the Juvenile Justice Committee particularly wanted to hear from the commission what the commission's expectation was for as a committee to weigh in on legislative bills. And so Jill, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit more about that or give some context to the juvenile justice group's specifics.
Well, I think it's fair to say this juvenile committee is very active, and we've talked about a number of issues over the last year or maybe a couple of years. A number of issues have come to the full commission for a vote and also have found themselves in pending legislation. So I think it's just a question from the committee. Once the sentencing commission votes on a particular matter and then that finds itself in a piece of legislation, what role, what should the committee expect, I think, is the role of the sentencing commission in terms of testifying, whether proponent, opponent, or interested party, you know, how does the commission interact with the State House on pending matters that came from this body?
Thoughts about that? Okay. Representative Rocha is here. He has pending legislation that is, you know, started with some of the recommendations that we made. So how, moving forward, does the commission want to weigh in or not? Do they want to give a committee the ability to weigh in as a committee of the commission, or should it be from the commission? We're looking for some guidance and your thoughts as a commission member.
Well, and I'll jump in because you did a presentation.
Two weeks ago.
It was just the history of sentencing. And although on the Criminal Justice Committee, all but two are actual lawyers. And even as lawyers, I think only three of us or two of us actually do criminal work, it was so enlightening. That just to getting a, whether it's a history or not necessarily taking a stance one way or the other, but I think that entire background and just an insight as to whether it's from the Sentencing Commission or from the court kind of perspective, I think that made a major impact on some of the committee members of, you know, some of them were, oh, I didn't realize that. I didn't understand pre-Senate Bill 2 stuff, and post-Senate Bill 2, and House Bill 86, and all the changes. And I think it's just, I think every so often on some of these larger bills, it is important that the commission provide that information and that data, because it's, you don't get that from all the other witnesses. from a historical perspective that the Sentencing Commission and the court would have. And I think it was very informative. So I would encourage us to continue on that. That, you know, it gets very dicey. You know, if you want to say they're going to be a proponent or opponent or just an interested party, I think interested party is where the stance should be. But that this is why, or at least give the explanation of where if there are recommendations where we ended up coming from, I think it's very important perspective for committees, whether it's criminal justice or other things.
Sarah, might this be an appropriate time to get this, which was not technically on the agenda, about the bill response? Because by way of example, you did history. I think the concept of this is that we deal with legislation as it comes up, whether it's something that we've already worked on or something that hits the plate, that discuss the concept. I mean, the concept makes sense that if we like it, we take the word draft off, and the question is how we use it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's both. In the conversations that I've had with others, it's been, well, it's a, the commission ought to provide that perspective, that historical background, and give that informative piece. And how is that different then from that analysis and what LSC does? And so our analysis would be more focused as opposed to an LSC analysis and try to hit the high points when it comes to sentencing past practice and kind of how we got to where we are now and where it may be impactful later. So I think it's two tracks. And it just talk whether you wanted to talk and give me that direction by way of commission, which we only meet quarterly, and so that's really not timely. The commission has been criticized for not being responsive in a timely manner in the past, or if there's a small group that wants to kind of drive and to, give the approval on behalf of the commission to make these things happen more quickly, I'm open to that. We haven't had that conversation, and I'm not comfortable as director saying, oh, well, this is what I'm going to do. And I hope you guys agree. Now, the historical perspective was pretty easy because I think that it's informative for all of us. But moving forward and as we become fully staffed in the office, I think we can play a more relevant role, and it needs to be a timely one if we're going to do it. We have to have a conversation.
I think this is what I'll call the reactive process. And I would suggest that, I mean, this is an easy PDF, whatever that is. There's bills that we think are interesting. Because my impact may be different than the DRC's or the mayor or the sheriff, but you then can collate that up. I query whether we need to approve it quarterly or just here's what our members have said from all the various perspectives. Would it be proper for me to make a motion, Sarah, that we approve the draft form and then you can start implementing it? If so, I would so move. This was in your materials. If you didn't get a chance to look at it, basically it's a responsive paper thing, although it's a PDF, I think, for most of us.
Yeah, I was just going to offer some more discussion. To the extent that, I'm fine with the form, and I think the form is good and all that kind of stuff, but a lot of times we have a division of thought, and so I would recommend that we add, not necessarily add, but if there's a majority view and a minority view, that both views be presented, because I think some of the members may not want to participate as much if they feel like they're, I'm not saying we have to have 10 views, but if we can kind of summarize a majority view and then a minority view, I think the legislature may also find that helpful. So, to the extent that the impact, we give impacts, I would love to, if we have diversion of thought, have majority view, minority view.
If that's an amendment, I accept it as a friendly amendment, because I think what may happen is you can collect all the comments from all the perspectives, and if we're going to do an up or down vote, then you say, well, we got 9-0, or we got 11-10, and here are the two viewpoints. I agree with Nick.
Again, it's important to have both of those views so the legislators can
agree. There's a hand over there.
No, I was
Oh, okay. How did you?
Oh, I guess it's right.
Yeah, you're in charge now.
All right, so there's been a motion and a second with a friendly amendment. Any more discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Beautiful. Passes. The next thing on what do we want to talk about, the Criminal Justice Committee. Jared Spanagle.
Oh, the sentencing criminal justice. Okay, as to bail reform, things are happening, but as we know, they always happen slowly. I think, was it before or after the September meeting that we got the notification from the rules people?
I think it was before.
Okay, well, anyway, but the Supreme Court did not take it into this year's January cycle. It should be on the next year's cycle. Judge Bill Finnegan was at one presentation we did after the meeting to one of our groups on bail reform. He is chair of the rules process from the non-Supremes, so that should be moving. Sarah's gotten the bill into the legislature. I think it's 439, right, Sarah?
Correct.
Which is the statutory bail reform. The quick skinnies, it would, the statutory part, not the criminal rules part, set up that a valid risk assessment tool should be used in bail determinations. As currently drafted, would give the commission the ability slash authority to come up with a list of, I guess Sarah will call them, approved valid risk assessment tools. Would that be appropriate?
I think the language is validated risk assessment.
Validated, but either way, giving us the ability to come up with things besides ORAS and Arnold and stuff. I haven't read it yet. IdeaStream, which is Channel 25, our PBS people in Cleveland, that the Justice Institute came out on Monday with their bail reform report. I have not seen it. You may, Sarah, make a side note to download it off the Buckeye and send it to us. The bail agents responded in one of their organizations on Tuesday, which I have not read. Of course, they believe that cash bail is not that unfair. So that's out there. Maybe I can get you the link to this article, Sarah, to the extent you may wish to raise on that.
Yeah, I'll send that out.
Okay. Reagan Tokes, we sort of talked about. Sarah, if you want to give any follow-up report as to your history, which was very good if you all got it and read her testimony. Anything you want to add on that? Okay.
No, thank you.
And then in recon, I will yield to Tim, wherever Tim's at, as to whatever that may be or not, as to what's going on with recon, the General Assembly, and our involvement.
Judge Gallagher, would you like to present now?
Oh, no, I
don't. Can we pick up, or do you?
No, go ahead. Do whatever you're doing.
I want to be respectful of your time.
No, no, that's fine.
Good.
Yeah.
Sarah had asked if we could put together a little bit of a comparison of data between RECOD and Reagan Tokes. I don't think either, at least the sentencing provisions of both. And so I think being handed around now are two sheets that kind of give you just a brief overview of substantial similarities and differences. Both RECOD and for sentencing purposes and Reagan Tokes proposed to return to indefinite sentencing schemes. The major functional difference occurs when you start looking at consecutive sentencing. On concurrent sentencing, they're fairly similar, or on single charge sentencing, because you don't have an aggregate sentencing difference. What I mean by that, and the example on the second page, and we'll get into it a little bit more later, under RECOD, the tail, if you will, is determined by the highest level charge. So on a single charge, it doesn't make any difference. So if you get a 10-year sentence, your sentence is 10 to 15. If you got an 8-year sentence, your sentence would be 8 to 12. So whatever half of that number is. The same is true under Reagan Tokes until you start stacking sentences. The moment you start stacking sentences, these two diverge fairly significantly. Under RECOD, you still only look at that single highest. So if you had an F1 and an F2, 10 years on one, 8 years on the other, stacked, you're looking at an 18-year sentence. Under RECOD, it's 18 to 23, 5 years of the 10. Under Reagan Tokes, it's half of the aggregate. And I'm going to stay away from spec time, because spec time just makes this really confusing, so I'm not going to throw it in there. But under Reagan Tokes, suddenly you're looking at half of 18. So it's 9 years. So you're looking at 18 to 27 as the tail. So that's the major fundamental difference that occurs there. Todd also recommended indefinites across the board. Reagan-Tokes limits it to ones, twos, and threes. Excuse me. There's also a fairly significant difference at the tail on the release side of the world. Both work towards what we would call a presumptive release for parole. That is, it would be up to DRC to show misbehavior in the prisons to continue holding somebody past that minimum sentence. RECOD would only have parole hearings if DRC were intending to keep somebody. If we're reading Reagan-Tokes correctly, there'd be a parole hearing for everybody who was on an indefinite sentence. If I have it wrong, please correct me, but the way it seems to read is there's a reasonable presumption, but it doesn't say there's no hearing specifically. That worries us a little about the workload. If it is intended otherwise, I think we probably need to clear it up with the language. There's a presumptive release. The big difference then comes on the tail of this whole situation, and I think it's very significant. That's where the second page of the handout comes in that gives two examples. Back to the single count. I give you present law, RECOD and Reagan-Tokes. F1 sentenced to 10 years. Under present law, 10 years, and then up to 5 more on PRC. If you violate 5 PRC, you can get up to 1/2 of the original sentence. RECOD, 10 to 15. Can't serve beyond the 15. The case is over if you serve all 15. If you're paroled at 10, you can be on parole for up to 5 years, and then have all 5 reimposed or be re-paroled at some point in time. Under Reagan-Tokes, again, it's 10 to 15, single charge, but even if you're closing in on all 15, you could still serve 5 PRC where you're at risk for 5 more. Half of the minimum. So you really are at risk for up to 20 under Reagan-Tokes on a 10 to 15. Again, where it really, really plays out and starts to get dramatically different is when you're looking at consecutive sentences. The second example, 3F2s, present law, if you max and stack them, you're looking at 24 years, 8 years on each. Again, with PRC, half the minimum comes in. Potentially up to 12 more years possible if you violate PRC. RECOD, it's 24 to 28 because you only take half of one of the highest levels, so you would do 4 more potentially for that tail. If you serve all 28, you're done. Reagan-Tokes, again, it's half, so it's 24 to 36 because you're doing that aggregate minimum time, plus you're at risk upon that release or PRC, again, which puts you again at risk for half of the minimum of Reagan-Tokes. So it's really 48 years is the exposure on 3F2 for maximum. Basically, the fundamental rule, without getting into specs on Reagan-Tokes, at least at presently written, and we understand it's a fairly significantly moving target at this point, but at presently written, you should double any low number is the top number. Once you count in the PRC side, and you should double any aggregate if it's a stacked sentence, if it's a consecutive sentence, for the actual potential back end. So you really start to get to some fairly significant numbers, especially on high-end felonies, where you're much more likely to see a lot of your consecutive sentencing, where you've got multiple victims on felonious assaults, where you've got multiple cases where there are multiple injuries. You're going to see more consecutives on those ag robberies and burglaries and these kinds of cases. That's where Reagan-Tokes really is going to play out at the back end of our sentencing structure. If I, you know, I don't have the calculus to do the math on this, but I'd start digging a hole for it in prison if you pass Reagan-Tokes as it's presently written. That's what it's going to add in terms of this long-term Fed population. Because these aren't short-termers that are going to see these long ends. These are beds that you're talking about filling for 10 and 20 years when you start adding those consecutive tails. So, happy to answer any questions you have, or if I've made any mistakes, please correct us. It really is, Reagan-Tokes is what, 800 pages, I think. I'm not saying we've read it all.
I've got not a question, but a comment. And I mentioned part of this at the Criminal Justice Subcommittee meeting. The concern that I have with Reagan-Tokes and and even the recodification proposal is this. A lot of these kinds of sentences come into play in high-profile cases where the scrutiny is a lot higher and the pressures on different facets of the system are immense. And when we start developing a sentencing formula or sentencing scheme where we've got to take great pains to calculate a lot of ambiguous language, it invites error and it invites trouble. And criminal reach, or the Justice Reinvestment Group has already looked at our sentencing statutes on OBIs and other offenses and have said that we have one of the most complex in the nation. So why are we starting to develop a plan of sentencing where we're talking about complexities? And even our public defender said at the outset of his presentation, I'm not going to talk about specs because it's too complicated for this kind of understanding. Now, the impact of this is that most, if not all, judges will come around and be proficient with their calculators probably. And I hope to be one of those, although I can't guarantee it. The real impact is going to be for the prosecutors in this way. You know, under Marcy's law, prosecutors are going to have more interaction with victims. And victims now, I guess it's been suggested, are allowed to have significant input on whether pleas are to be accepted. So can you imagine sitting in a room with the victim's family and explaining this mathematical formula under different scenarios about how this is going to work out? And I can tell you from personal experience that victims are not going to understand the explanations of the sentencing scheme. Now, is that a reason to set aside everything we're doing? No. But I would really caution our General Assembly as well as other partners in this that we think about how are these things going to be carried out? Do we need some tougher sentences for some more serious felons? Yeah. But how are we going to go about carrying this out? And as a practical matter, prosecutors are going to have a very difficult time with victims' families. And in my opinion, I believe that we invite error in high-profile cases when we have to start getting our calculator out to figure out our sentences. Any other discussion? Yes.
Well, being that it's my first meeting, I was not planning on saying anything today. So I just want to say I really do appreciate the feedback. I hope everyone in this room knows that as one of the authors and the sponsors of the Regotopes Act, it's very important for us to work with everyone to develop a system that I know that not everyone will be 100% happy with, but will be the best system that we can put forward. And so I appreciate the time and the attention that this body has put into analyzing the legislation. I anticipate having conversations with several of you over the holidays so that we can put the polish on the bill that we know needs to be there. So I just wanted to say thank you for that.
Thank you. Other comments or questions?
Sarah, I know 201 is Reagan-Tokes. I know, Senator Eklund, you got 66. The OCCCA document, which I think we got from one of our presentations, was a side-by-side of Senator Eklund's bill, Reagan-Tokes, and RECOD. That might also be a good educational thing if we can get that and send it out to everybody, and I'm not sure if you've sent it out already or not. This one.
I
mean, for example, Senator Eklund's bill has our ILC proposals, then you got RECOD, and then you get to the Reagan-Tokes pieces, and they match all three of them. There's obviously some blend of 201-66 might wind up coming out as a package.
So during the testimony, testimony of the condensed 40-year history. The question and answer period from the committee members focused on, so where is the commission? What do you think about the recall recommendations versus Reagan Coates, which is one of the reasons that prompted us to ask the vice chair of recall and also one of our members to kind of take the two side by side. But I think Rep Manning, as well as the committee, was interested in what's going to be workable and what's going to give people and restore public confidence in our system. And frankly, my answer was simplification. The more simple it is, and the better people understand it, the more confidence they'll have in it. And there were probably, I think, in looking at Rep Reza, but there are two or three questions from the members about, well, you know, what's the commission think? Have you analyzed them? Are you going to make take a position, so to speak? And so one of the reasons it's on the agenda today is for us as a group to talk about how and if we proceed on trying to line up what we would recommend if we had the opportunity to meet with Representative Bogg, Representative Hughes, and all those that have an interest in moving the bill forward. And so I don't know, Joe Savaggio, if that's a small group. I'm not sure that the meeting of the Sentencing and Criminal Justice Committee in January, the timing is going to be such that our feedback would be relevant if we wait until the monthly meeting.
So, well, maybe we can do it this way. So, you know, Sarah and I had talked about kind of refashioning the way the Sentencing Commission does business, and so you've heard a little bit about us wanting to be a little more proactive in comment on legislation. Maybe I could ask Representative Boggs, from your perspective, what's the easiest vehicle to have discussion with you? Is it to, or you and the other member, is it to form a little subgroup and have discussion about specifics, or do you want some more broad-based feedback, or what? Give us some insight.
The best I think I can answer that question, and maybe I can start with telling you sort of what our anticipated timeline is. So we are going to be working over the next 3 weeks, Representative Hughes, Representative Manning, and I, to develop the amendments that we believe are necessary to fine-tune the bill and to get it the support that it needs from all the stakeholders. So with that in mind, I think if there are, the more specific you can be, I think is better for us, and especially the more specific you can be related to the bill we have at hand. So if there are identified changes that will earn your support, we really want to know what those recommended changes are. And then if you're able to put that, you know, in some type of writing or some type of memo that you can get to Representative Hughes and Representative Manning and myself, and then we could have a meeting as either an interested party meeting or sitting down with you individually, the members of the committee that you put together, I think that the three of us would be very happy to do that.
So as a practical matter, like I'm here on behalf of the Common Pleas Judges Association. So I'm not speaking for my association.
Oh.
But I would presume, I mean, because I don't know that that's necessarily how we're set up, but I would presume that I'm going to go back to, well, and maybe ask Paul and Josh to say, hey, look, through the Sentencing Commission, we're being given the opportunity to have a voice in constructively giving input on what we think of the legislation. Give us your feedback, or give it so that we can pass it along. Because I think one of the problems, at least I as a member of the Sentencing Commission have always had, is who am I representing here? I'm being named by the Common Pleas judges to come here, but I don't really meet with my judges before I come here. You know what I mean? So because we have the Prosecutors Association here and the Attorney General's Office here and Judges Association and stuff, it sounds like what we really need to do is maybe fine-tune our own, not relationships, but communication avenues with our respective associations, and let them know, hey, we've got this window open and we need your comments by such and such date, and then I or Judge Marceline or somebody from my own association then funnels it back to Sarah, and then, I mean, is that, do you want it solely from the Sentencing Commission as a whole, or is it better to ask the Prosecutors Association to submit their position, how these judges to submit their position, the Public Defender's Office to submit their position to some clearinghouse, and then all that gets sent over?
So the best I can answer that question is that if the stakeholder has submitted testimony in as it relates to the bill in either the Senate or the House, I think all of the sponsors of the bill would appreciate hearing from them on their own as it relates to their suggested changes. If they are not intending on appearing in committee to testify on the bill, I think joining with another stakeholder and signing on to their suggested changes is appropriate. Does that make sense?
As a legislative novice, kind of, but I can figure it out with Paul and Josh as to like how best to communicate the message. But you're saying the window is about 3 weeks.
Ideally, yeah. I think that we're very much planning on trying to fine-tune the bill while the legislature is out for recess, so that we have something that we can submit either as a sub-bill or the appropriate amendments to the bill that's been introduced when the committee meets when they come back.
If I may.
Yeah, please.
You've hit on something I think that's very, very important, okay? Diverse group of folks and organizations represented here. Each group maybe has their own association, like the county police, judges, who are prosecutors, all of them have their particular twist on things. So I would find it very difficult for a group like this to come to any kind of a consensus, even one that makes everybody equally miserable, on a particular piece of legislation. Okay? Rather, it seems to me, this group can provide information sort of almost independent, you know, like an expert panel who provides information to inform the committee work and the legislature's work. And if each of your organizations has a particular twist, you know, I would say bring it on separately. You know what I'm saying? So that there's not that danger of cross purposes at work. Because you could have a position coming out of the Sentencing Commission with which the prosecuting attorneys all disagree, but nevertheless it comes out of the commission, and what's a mother to do at that point, right? I mean, it becomes a little bit more confusing. And I personally, anyway, and this has got nothing to do necessarily with the pending bills, I find that the information coming from this body being sort of informing the thought process as opposed to taking a position is oftentimes more valuable, because then the committee and the legislature is able to evaluate the various interest groups, and I mean that in the kindest way, and what they want to see happen, informed by third-party, independent, deep thinkers, as opposed to just throwing another point of view onto the table. Just.
Okay. Senator Eckman couldn't have said it better. My thing was, many of you have your organizations. I think for the Sentencing Commission, it is really about some information gathering, and I still think that that information in the form that we just passed would be very helpful. Whether it's to take an extra position, but I think and I go back to the testimony. For people that were there, it really was an eye-opening experience to go through that history, through
through 40 years in less than like 20 minutes. So it was amazing. But it was just that information that a lot of individuals who don't specifically work in that area, they just didn't know. And it was very informative. And I think that is what was extremely helpful to the members of the committee that helped them start to understand and saying, oh, here, maybe then this is an issue or this is an issue. And it can assist with any of the other associations' positions that if we have something from the commission as a generic, not necessarily a position, but as generic as information, then we can pose better questions probably, or at least come up and work with the sponsors of the bills and say, you know, what about this? It really does. It really helps us to make a better law.
I don't want to weigh in here too, because I totally agree with what some of that just said. It seems to me improbable. Tim Young's here, Blue over there for the prosecutors and the judges, that said you're going to find many things on which there's the majority and minority opinions. You may find some, but taking this bill as an example, it seems to me that the Sentencing Commission might be able to gather together with the assistance of the department some thoughts on the impact of prison population. That's sort of a neutral item, that's more of what some guys want to. That kind of input, I would think, something on which there might not be much disagreement.
Or another example, insofar as something like a piece of legislation that's pending in Ohio has been tried and implemented in Michigan or Louisiana or wherever, someplace else around the country or the world, plumbing those depths, because and saying, okay, here's where it's been done 5 years ago, and here's what's happened, and draw your conclusions. At least there's some experience. Most legislators are going to, however valuable or unimportant that information might be, it's a data point that I think this organization is uniquely qualified to provide. Again, in a dispassionate sort of fashion, is here's some information, the effect on prison populations, or what has been the effect on prison populations in Montana when they did this. Things like those deep dives that I think inform the ultimate policy decision without having to take a position that maybe nothing more than a funnel through which all these disparate independent views of the world come. So, thanks, Jeff.
Good comments. Thank you for responding. So, any more criminal justice either feedback to Reagan Tokes or anything else we've discussed?
History, and there's lots of people here from DRC, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm going to keep it sort of simple. In 2016, ODRC started a TCAP pilot program in four counties, and one of them was Lucas County, and that is Judge Zamuda's ward. So the idea was that these counties would receive funding from ODRC and in turn agree to supervise, treat, and sanction a targeted population locally and not send those people to prison. That targeted population was non-mandatory prison, non-sex offenses, non-violent offenses, and they were all F5, except in Lucas and
Lucas had a multi-county grant.
Yeah.
It included some rural counties surrounding Lucas, Fulton, Henry, Defiance,
Williams.
Yes.
And it did include F4s as well.
All of those counties included F4s.
So the 2017 biennial budget included that TCAP program and expanded it to 10 of the largest counties in Ohio as a requirement, and then other counties could participate if they decided to. As of December of this year, 48 counties are participating in TCAP, and then an additional 5 out of those 10 mandated counties will have to participate in fiscal year 2018. So there have been some implementation glitches to TCAP that the Judicial Associations and the Judicial Conference are trying to address. One way that we've attempted to address this is to have Judge Zabuda speak with judges at the Common Pleas Judges Association Winter Conference, which happened last week. He gave a presentation about TCAP, how he's implemented it in Lucas County, and procedures that work, I guess, for him. And the Judicial Conference also hosted a roundtable after Judge Zabuda's presentation to discuss TCAP implementation in other counties. We also discussed other sentencing changes that were in HB 49 that were not specific to TCAP, but that applied to all courts. 29-29-15 changes, specifically increased eligibility for judicial release and limiting prison sanctions for violations of community control sanctions. There are 90-day and 180-day caps for FIs and F4s, respectively. So that's something that we're working on and something that we hope to be talking with ODRC soon about. I guess that's all I really have to say at this point, unless anyone's
asking. No, I mean, I don't think from our end we have any implementation issues. We processed all the agreements, were all processed, and the money's all, the court payments were all made. And we're at the point now of analyzing the commitments that we received thus far to determine if there will be any deduction, so to speak, of the next payment based on commitments that weren't within the grant agreement. So, but besides that, nothing on our end that's prohibiting any of the funding getting out. It's all been done.
Yeah, so to clarify, I think the hitches have been mostly legislative and interpreting the new law and seeing how that applies to everybody. Some of this was written during controversial topic during a short couple of months, which resulted in some conflicting language. And so,
haste makes waste.
So that said, some of what the roundtable was attempting to do was develop suggestions for changes to streamline implementation and just kind of make sure that the stated goals of TCAP are actually going to be realized.
Not to revert to old business, but here's another perfect example of how this body can be extremely helpful. You get the Judicial Conference to come up with a bunch of ideas, either administratively or statutorily, and how to fix what we've got so far, right? They can present that to the legislature through whatever mechanism they like, but an organization like the Judicial Conference might provide a copy of their comments or their thoughts or the work product of that work group to the Sentencing Commission. The Sentencing Commission can look at it, and if there is something additional, some additional information that they can lay their hands on that can inform the consideration in the legislature of your proposal,
perfect,
right? You can advocate based on what's in the best interest of your folks, but the Sentencing Commission can serve, again, as this sort of super panel of thought. Sorry to interrupt, but that's a great example.
Well, some of that does sort of happen. I mean, the Criminal Law and Procedure Committee, we do a lot of threads, of which I sometimes speak. Nick, Sarah's on the list on those, so she gets pretty much whatever the stream of consciousness is on the Criminal Law Procedure Committee. You can then know what to pick up from the conference piece that should also be our piece, whether a separate thread or getting to more formal action.
All right, other comments? All right, do we want to finish up the committee reports with Justice Reinvestment, or do we want to turn to Judge Gallagher?
Finish up if you want.
And then next on our agenda is Justice Reinvestment.
Data next turn?
Well, we weren't going to.
No. I mean, well, Carl and Patrick are here. And I was going to, during my report, just acknowledge their presence and thank them for coming back and ask them if they wanted to say anything while they're here. But there's no formal presentation.
Oh, all right. I was looking at perhaps another sheet.
Yeah.
Well, then guess what? It's showtime. Dim the lights and let's go.
I guess I better walk somewhere to the center of the room, huh?
Yeah, that's probably a good idea.
Well, thanks, everybody. I woke up this morning and I had, I don't know how you got here. You live south.
Last night, not the best drives we got.
I woke up with a foot of snow in the driveway. My wife has pink eye. I came down here. There's only one spot to park in a lot out here. And of course, I'm at spot number 13. So I'm just off to a roaring start today. But my name is Sean Gallagher. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. As we like to say, the People's Republic of Cleveland. I really want to just take a few minutes to talk about the sentencing review. I kind of thought about something when I came in the room, which was there were a lot of discussions about the proposals for changing the sentencing process in Ohio, and I thought this is a good way for me to do a little segue, because I think a lot of times we spend a lot of time thinking about, writing about, and frankly passing bills and laws that change the way we do things in Ohio, but we forget sometimes about what's going to happen when those changes have to be reviewed, and that's where the appellate judges come into this equation. And I say that because when I was a felony prosecutor in the early 90s, prior to Senate Bill 2, I never wrote one appeal on a sentencing issue. No one ever appealed a sentence. You went to prison, and then what you hoped for, whether you got reformatory time in those days or prison time in those days, you just counted the days until you get to the parole board. It didn't matter who your judge was. All that changed on July 1st, 1996, when the most important day in any criminal justice proceeding now in Ohio is, who do I get at arraignment day? Now, maybe that doesn't matter in a one-judge county, but even when you have a county with two county police judges, there could be a significant difference for both the prosecution and the defense over what's going to happen to you. Well, when you go to, I would invite anybody to go to Cuyahoga County County Police Court arraignment room, 34 county police court judges. The inmates are all sitting in the room waiting to get their assigned judge. The judge doing the arraignments peels off a sticker and reads the judge's name. And the inmates, many of whom are frequent flyers, either groan with agony for the poor person who just got assigned to that judge, or there's screams of jubilation over their case. So that's what we've come to, Franklin, Ohio, is the most important thing. Who do I get at arraignment? And I don't know that that's really a good process to have. So I passed out some things, some documents. I brought 50 of them. I hope there's enough for everybody.
Yeah,
but
I have
two left. Wow, great. Time to break. Perfect. Sierra Club will love us all. So I just want to kind of walk through this, and I see we got some county police judges here, so I better tread softly. And one former justice from the court, so I better not criticize some of their cases too loudly. I know my place. But I want to just walk you through this kind of quickly, and I know your time is limited, but I want to start off by talking about we are having a crisis in Ohio with appellate review of felony sentencing. There's no other way to say that. There are 69 appellate judges in Ohio, and I can tell you, they're all over the board. And it's because the statute, the reviewing statute, is completely unreadable. I would challenge anybody to read 295308 as it's presently constituted. And I'm not trying to criticize the legislature for this, because it's been a Frankenstein statute is what's happened to it. But it was originally passed as part of Senate Bill 2 in 96, and it was really designed to be a limited statute when it was drafted. We were going to allow certain appeals for certain things on a limited basis back then. And since then, it's now become the be-all, catch-all for all felony review. But it's written in a way that is completely unworkable. It has a phrase in it called contrary to law. If I started at this end of the room and worked my way across and asked everybody, what does the term contrary to law mean to you? We will have 15 to 20 different interpretations of what that is. And that affects prosecutors, victims, and it affects defendants when they go to be sentenced. So I want to start out by talking real briefly about this case, State v. Markham. Back in May of 2016, the Ohio Supreme Court decided to get the standard of felony review in the appellate system back in line with what the statute was. We had a case called State v. Kalish years earlier, which established an abuse of discretion standard for felony sentencing review. And so that meant that a trial court had to abuse his or her discretion, or they wouldn't get reversed. We went to what's called the clear and convincing standard, which was written in the 295308 passages. It's a very, very confusing standard. You'd like to think clear and convincing would be clear and convincing. It's not. It's written in the negative. So it doesn't mean that a trial judge has to have clear and convincing evidence to do something. It means the appellate court has to clearly and convincingly find that the trial court didn't have something. Very, very convoluted and very, very complicated. Well, part of the problem with State v. Markham was that it premised its review of parts of felony sentencing, and I don't want to get too technical here, but 29.29.11 and 29.29.12 are passages that trial judges like Judge Marceline and Judge Sabagio knows these like the back of their hands. They review them, they go through that, and they say that in their journal entries and on the record that they reviewed all that. The problem is there's no provision under the current drafted 295308 that authorizes a review of that. Yet in State v. Markham, the Ohio Supreme Court said, we want you to review it and give it the same deference that you give anything else. So essentially, Markham was premised on a passage of 295308 that once was in there, but in 2000, the legislature removed it. When House Bill 86 was passed in 2011, I think, or October 2011, they didn't put it back in. So we don't really have it. So it's a very convoluted and confusing statute. Again, when I say this about not being able to review things efficiently, I'll bet, we have some sheriff's people here, don't we? Somewhere in this room? Well, they're part of it, right? Sure. So what I always say about it is this. Here's the sheriff right there. The most expensive piece of legislation in recent Ohio history is Senate Bill 2. Why? It's not because necessarily the cost of inmates in prison. It's the cost of the sheriff having to drive inmates back and forth from prisons back to courthouses to be resentenced for failing to state something or other. And it's all nonsense. We're wasting, and I'm a Democrat, we're wasting millions and millions of taxpayer dollars ordering transcripts, assigning lawyers, driving inmates back from prisons, putting them in front of a judge for the judge to say, that was the worst form of the offense, or that was this, or that was that, and then shipping the guy back, because we don't think about it. What's the review process? So I would beg you to look at this. So I don't want to take up too much time, but I really, really think that what the Supreme Court, and I'm not being critical of them because I think they're frustrated with 29.53 like every appellate judge is. It's unreadable. It's undefinable, all these terms that are in there. And I think the authors of Senate Bill 2, I've talked to Bert Griffin many times about this, he thought this would be ferreted out over time, and it just hasn't been, unfortunately. So our problem really is that we just need some clarity, and we really probably need a new 29-5308. And I'm not going to come empty-handed. Now, I cannot speak for all appellate judges because we've kind of discussed this, and we had a conference call, and Justice Pfeiffer was on it, and I think we're still trying to work through this. But I have brought you a proposed change for 29-5308. Now, I can't say that this would be doable if you pass the recodification proposal or if you go with the other. It's the first time I've heard it. Reagan Totes, is that it? It sounds like the former president is smoking something. But this proposal, kind of, what it does is, I guess I should give a little history of this. When I was a prosecutor, and there were appeals filed, and it's usually about the admission of evidence, the admission of, can I get this in, can I use this, can I use... That doesn't happen anymore because we don't have trials anymore. So what happens? Every defendant that goes to prison appeals his or her sentence. And though that's the new appellate review. The times that I get a chance to review something in the evidence rules under 600, it's rare anymore. It just doesn't happen. So we're reviewing felony sentences nonstop. Every case gets appealed. So I understand that because when I was a prosecutor, I would hear the defendant say, how much time am I going to have to do to his lawyer? That's what they wanted to know. How much time am I going to have to do? And so what I've tried to do with the help of several people a lot smarter than me is put together something that might be at least workable for your body as a whole to at least look at as a starting point. Get rid of all these confusing terms like contrary to law and other terms, authorized by law, all these terms that are in there that are just escape definability. And if everybody wants to appeal, that's fine, but the gist of this proposal would be that if a judge like Judge Marceline sentences within the range for the assigned offense, there would be a presumption of proportionality and a presumption of consistency because the legislature has established what the penalty is. Now, we'll let a defendant still appeal that if he or she really wants to. Let's say you have an 18-year-old that has a felony one and he gets 11 years. You know, the defender might want to say, hey, look, I want to appeal that. I think that's a little too high. Maybe he should have gotten 8 or 7 or whatever. I don't have a problem if they want to appeal those sentences. That's fine. But I think that when judges sentence within a range and it's not consecutive, it should be accepted as there should be a presumption that that's a valid sentence. Now, the real problem that everybody in the defense bar complains about, and I think prosecutors look at this too, are consecutive sentences. You know, we have cases where we get a case where somebody who's looking at child porn gets 80 years in prison. I mean, it happens in Ohio. There are examples like this. Now, I'm not a fan of people that have child porn. I mean, you know, but 80 years, and then we're supposed to review it and say, oh, no, that's not good or that. So I mean, obviously, I think some of those cases like that should be looked at. I have an example in here of a case from the Second District, State v. Beasley, where one defendant, these are bad guys, they're young, but they're bad guys. One guy gets 30 years, the other guy gets 13 and a half years. Same crime, co-defendants. I mean, okay, I'm sure that Judge Nick and Judge Tom, and I think the trial judge probably did get it right, because one guy had a horrible record versus the other guy, but we ought to have a process of review where we can effectively review those sentences. So what I would suggest in this proposal is, and what others have suggested is, if we could put the factors back into, the 29-29-12 factors back into consecutive sentences. There, 29-29-12 has about 24, 27, you guys would know better than I, seriousness and recidivism factors. Most judges engage in good civics, and they read these into the record anyway. I mean, when you have a judge that really is on top of it, they'll point out which factors they're relying on anyway. But it would at least give us something tangible to work off of. So that's the gist of this, to try to create some... There's never going to be a perfect system for sentencing review, but we're going to need something. Because whatever changes you do make in the end, they are going to have to be reviewed at some point And you don't want to go down that path where you're spending an inordinate amount of taxpayer dollars needlessly driving guys back and forth and having judges have to resentence people because they didn't say this magic word or that magic word. So, Director Andrews, I really appreciate you giving me the chance to stand up and say this. I can't say this is something that every appellate judge has signed off on. They haven't. I'm going to try to go to each one of them and get their feedback on it, but we could sure use your help in trying to come up with something that fixes this problem at least and gives us a more reviewable standard. I've also thrown in free, no charge, some appellate judge comments on the recodification proposal, and there's a couple of things in there that we do find very concerning, and I'll be real fast on that, if I can be. One of the things is that we see is that you're going to have appellate judges writing the, or not you are, but the proposal has appellate judges writing if they reverse a sentence, they're going to write the journal entry. That's a disaster waiting to happen. Can you imagine the prison system getting a journal entry from me? Trying to figure out what it says? It's not going to happen. It's not going to work. So I put it in there. I think they're self-explanatory. You can look at them. There are some concerns in there about some of the language. Recodification still keeps the phrase contrary to law. We see that as really problematic. But these are all self-explanatory. So, I don't know. Justice Pfeiffer, do you want to say anything?
No.
All right. Listen, I thank you very much for hearing me, but we'd really love if you could at some point look at this and maybe put it into some committee and cut it up and do something with it so we can get a workable one. Thank you very much. And if you have any questions at all, I'd love to.
Thank you. I've worked really hard on this and keep plugging away. We had a conference call with his colleagues. It'd be fair to say they didn't all jump up and salute at the same time. But I think it's absolutely right. It is.
Sean, didn't you back when Dave was director, had a draft proposal for the appellate statute?
Yeah, David Girol, it's still there. It's still in the can.
Is this substantially different? Or is
it's pretty different. Yeah, okay. It's different. We try to take all the any word longer than six letters, we took it out.
Yeah, so the commission talked about appellate review in 2015 and made the recommendation, and Judge Gallagher has taken that as well as recod, and then where he's landed in the recommendation. And so do you think, Josh, or Justice Piper, or Judge Gallagher, will the appellate review community from that conference, or is it going to be something the conference tries to pursue?
Yes.
I just don't want us to interfere with that, or be at a competing time.
No, right? we'd like to keep working on it, and I just saw Scott here, and we'd like to feed it through Scott, and what's going to happen is we're going to need a vehicle. Even if we get to some consensus within the appellate judges, we're going to need a vehicle, and this is probably the best vehicle, or one of the best vehicles. I'm a Democrat. I don't know how anything gets done.
Well, the timing may not be right, but for example, Reagan Tokes, this is the kind they could go in it, but it doesn't sound like we're going to be ready in 3 to 4 weeks.
No.
And is that something that if we decide to approve it through us by March, will there still be vehicles before you all adjourn in May?
Well, I will push this really strongly at the very first appellate meeting in February. And it's possible we could have something between Scott and I by February. Yes.
And Josh, is there an appellate legislative committee? That February meeting is the next time your committee of the conference is meeting. Okay.
Meantime, if we have feedback, we'll share it.
Safe travels back.
Thank you.
Sean, the only flaw is there's no Volkswagen picture in this presentation. I always get a Volkswagen picture.
There's
when
no
you
heat in Volkswagens.
And you're welcome to stay, Judge Gallagher.
Yeah, I'll stick around. I like listening to this.
Got some food for you, too.
No, that's all right. No problem.
All right. Next on the agenda, Dr. Hickman.
Okay, so we are hoping to sort of start up a data work group. There is a description in the agenda, so I won't read through that. That's a little boring. But we are looking for folks who are interested in developing data experience, just content expertise about the sort of landscape that you currently do your work in. So anyone who's interested in participating, just let Sarah know. The goal is to use the work group to help guide how we present our data, how we share with the industry party, make sure we're thinking things through. She's already identified a project she's going to work with Judge Hine in Durham County, looking at some of the history of the diversion programs that they've done in the area and success in those. And then we have three that have just been identified to work on various projects. Hayden is here, so I'll skip Hayden for just a minute. Shane is going to potentially look at what states are doing, a subset of states are doing with respect to opioid treatment and relapse prevention programs, and maybe do a comparison piece or a suggestion piece for Ohio. Mike is going to look at the idea of drugs and investigate this question of crime versus relapse. And Hayden is here. I'll have maybe Hayden, you can stand up and tell just a little bit about yourself and the project that you think you might be working on.
Sure, yeah. Well, May is speaking today at the first meeting, so thank you. But I'm just planning on working on some sort of a comparative analysis between recodification and other states that have passed things since recodification, or people have tried similar methods. So I really just want to see, you know, what are the realistic impacts that these laws are going to have on, you know, things like prison population or costs or, you know, social impacts and that sort of thing. I haven't gotten too far on my project yet. I just started today, so.
Welcome to the bar.
Thank you so much. I did to pass the bar, but so that's my plan. Thank you.
Congratulations.
And just so Professor Berman, who has, I think he's the director now of the Drug Policy Education Institute at Ohio State that the Koch brothers granted him, I think it was $4 million for this policy institute. So Professor Berman is working with us and Hayden, and Hayden's kind of splitting his time between that institute as well as our work, and so we're hopeful to continue to join with those efforts as that policy group or process moves forward. I think it should be good for Ohio and good for us around the drugs law sentencing. So. So moving on to the director's report?
Yes.
Well, let me back up to the fellows doing the research on the drug law question. So the commission has struggled with that crime versus relapse conversation, and so that's why we wanted some people to dig into, you know, how many times is too many times, is how do we treat those offenses. And then the other one was important because as we look to move or not recod recommendations, we wanted to have some sense of how that would impact. So we're hopeful to have good information for the commission as well as our legislative partners probably in the spring. And the staffing update, we have two positions that have been posted. We had over 70 applications for both positions. One is the criminal justice counsel, and the other is a researcher. So we'll be looking to have those folks on board in the next couple months. I think we'll be doing first round interviews for the Criminal Justice Council yet this month. And the NASC 2018 conference, so as always, there's an association for everything, right? So there's a National Association of Sentencing Commissions. There's about 23 active commissions nationally, and they host an annual conference. In August of 2018, Ohio is hosting that conference. We are going to house folks at the DoubleTree Hotel right across the street from our place here. And we're going to combine a couple things. We're going to try to do some events at the steakhouse as well as the court building and really make it a great event and showcase Ohio. So we've asked for presentations from all of you. If you have ideas and suggestions, the executive committee from the National Association of Sentencing Commissions will review those presentation suggestions and set the conference agenda. It'll be a Monday, August 13th. It'll start late that afternoon, and then we'll have a reception at the State House that evening. There'll be an all-day Tuesday event, and then a half a day on that Wednesday. At least that's the tentative schedule. It would be nice if many of you or all of you could at least try to stop in or visit, attend the conference. It's an interesting group of people, a lot of academics as well as judges and legislators and other partners. I've only been to one meeting since I've been director. We have them in weird places. So Santa Fe, New Mexico was weird, but before that it was somewhere in Alaska, and I just couldn't repay to go to these things, and it didn't make sense. So we're excited to host it. I know we've gotten suggestions for panel presentations or presentations. If you have any, we'd love to showcase what Ohio is doing. I think many of you in this room have important and meaningful projects to talk about and share nationally. So please let me know. We'd like to have those presentations for review by December 19th. And then we kind of talked about the JRI folks, Carl and Patrick are here. I don't know if what you've heard today, if there's anything you want to engage with the group. We did create the ad hoc committee group. We met in November, and I'll turn it over to you guys for any comments.
Thanks, Sarah. I'm Carl Reynolds. This is Patrick Armstrong. We're from the Council of State Governments Justice Center, which is headquartered in New York City, where Patrick works. We have a little outpost in Austin, Texas, which is where I work. So we have formed this working group as a connected to the Sentencing Commission ad hoc working group. We had our launch presentation back about a month ago in November over in the Supreme Court of the Judicial Center. And this is the second time that we've done judicial investment work in Ohio. First time it's been mentioned on House Bill 86 in 2011 was connected to the Justice Investment Project here in Ohio. So we're referring to this one as JR 2.0 for purposes of keeping that straight in Ohio. Patrick and I have done this kind of work in states around the country. The Justice Center where we work has done Justice Reinvestment in about 26 states now. And in a couple of instances, including Pennsylvania where we are still working, we're on the second go-round, so Ohio's not alone in that, but it's one of only a handful of states that have really taken on the challenge of doing the JR project a second time around. And what those projects involve are a lot like what the Sentencing Commission involves. We have this working group that has representation of stakeholders throughout the criminal justice system. What we'll do that I think is kind of unique is both try to understand the crazy complexity of sentencing law and a lot of other laws in Ohio. That's kind of my job, is to sort of sort that all out and understand the status quo as well as all these things that are happening to the status quo and try to add some value to those conversations. But we also have a colleague named Jessica Gonzalez who's working with Lisa and folks at ODRC and folks at BCI to gather all the data she can get her hands on that will help to illustrate and show folks on this working group what the dynamics are in the criminal justice system. Who goes to prison, who gets on probation, who ends up in jail, how quickly do they get out, how quickly do they reoffend, and so on. So we try to really provide a very nice data-driven picture of what's happening in your system. And what happens as a result of that process is typically some consensus around a few ideas for developing policy. In general, the thrust of these projects is to try to ensure that your prison system is kind of right-sized for the people that, that really need to be in prison, and that to the extent that any savings can be extracted from right-sizing the prison system, that those savings, or at least some portion of it, can be reinvested typically further upstream in the criminal justice system, into more effective supervision, more effective treatment interventions, more effective, more resource law enforcement, something we've been doing in a couple of recent states, and that we sort of anticipate maybe a topic here in Ohio. So speaking of that, we just met with the sheriff yesterday. We're going to try to push a survey out to sheriffs and chiefs of police just in the next few weeks, right after the new year, to really get more of a feel from the practitioners in law enforcement what the challenges are that they're facing and how the state might be able to assist with those challenges without making any promises to folks about where we're going to end up. We want to be open to the possibility of the state better supporting what's happening at the local level. Because criminal justice is fundamentally a local government business, and Ohio, as you know, is fundamentally a local government kind of place. So we really want to try to understand the local systems and try to make sure that those that what happens locally is in the best interest of local government and state. I want to thank Judge Gallagher. I'm fascinated by the paper. I have read Kalish and I've read Markham, and I was totally confused. So I'm hoping that this is going to set me straight. This is I really agree with your comments about how the clear and convincing being in the negative, all that stuff had struck me, and I'm really glad to go and try to tackle it. Really fascinating for us to hear all the discussion here, so we appreciate being here, and I'll cut it off here. If there's any questions, I'm glad to try to answer.
Looks like we've completed our agenda for the day. Are there any other comments, thoughts, anything that anybody would like to bring up before we adjourn?
So our next meeting in March is back in this room, so I'll send that out.
All right, motion to adjourn.
Uh-oh.
All right, take care of them.